It's time to move on into the books of Samuel. If I was going to be real accurate, I would say not the books of Samuel, but the book of Samuel. Because originally this was one book until we get to 250 BC when the Bible was translated into Greek, from Hebrew into Greek. And the scrolls ended up having to be much larger. But as I think about 1 Samuel and how it applies to us, since I have to have this word "be" in front, right? In all of my titles for each of these books, "be changed" seems to me the best that I can come up with. Be changed. And I don't know how you feel about change. Some of us love change, you know, because it's just, we just want more and more changes in our lives. Others of us, temperament-wise, we don't. The only constant in life is change. The only thing that you can be assured of regarding change is that change will happen, you know? And I've seen this before, combustion due to extreme resistance to change, you know? Some of us really like it, some of us hate it. I wonder what kind of experiences you have right now. What kind of changes are you experiencing right now? Most of you are, you're just finishing up, you know, your first month here at the college. Wow, have you seen change in your life? You never realized you could get away with so little sleep, right? We've taken away your sleep time, you know. Why does God cause change? You know, God does it. God's the one who brings out change in our lives. We're still in the context here of the time of the judges. We haven't moved out of the period of the judges yet, really, when we're in 1 Samuel here. Because we moved out of the book of Judges, but there's still judges ruling the world, or ruling Israel. And they're very bad values. The Philistines are very strong at this time. And so Israel's kind of deteriorating from within, but they have a strong Philistine neighbors who are militarily superior and a more cohesive society. It doesn't really look very good when you open up the account here in Samuel. But God's a God of transition. God is a God of change. And we see that the Lord is working during this time of great weakness. In fact, he's been working through Boaz and Ruth to provide the family line of the one that he has designated to be the king of Israel. The model, the prototype, if you will, of all the kings that were to follow him. That is David himself. And so the transition that we see happening in 1 Samuel is this theocracy has become very degenerate. Having God as king didn't work, not because God was not a good king, but because the people didn't really follow God. So what do? Do you just keep going on and on like that? Keep telling people, well, God's your king, you should follow him. The Lord's plan was to raise up a monarchy. The Lord's plan was to work through the line of David. And he was working in Judges and in Ruth to provide all the way. So I think the purpose of this book, I'll say this book, singular, of Samuel, is to move from God as king to a monarchy, from a theocracy to a monarchy where man is king. Now, that man who's king is still supposed to be following the Lord. It's not like he follows his own, you know, his own ideas and that's it. But I think if we can understand what the change was happening for Israel, it'll help us to understand how God wants to use change in our own lives. My encouragement, of course, for you is to not be resistant to change. If you are, if you're resistant to change, you'll have a difficult time. You have to be flexible and willing for God to do what he wants to do. So why does God cause change? Is the question that I think the book is raising. What reasons would the Lord have to make us adjust to new environments over and over? Why do we have to keep doing this? My understanding of the exegetical idea of 1 Samuel, to sum up the book, is that God had always planned to rule through Davidic kings. That was his plan. He was using even man's sin and the disgusting things that people did in the time of the judges to raise up the right king. And we'll see the disgusting things, crazy things they did at the beginning of 1 Kings as well. I like what A Biblical Theology of the Old Testament, which is a book that has a lot of depth on this, talks about in terms of the theology of Judges to Ruth to Samuel. And if you go to page 193 in your notes, you'll see that Judges, as we saw, highlights the need for the monarchy. That's a key point of Judges. In those days, Israel had no king. It's saying that in kind of a negative sense. The reason why everyone did what was right in their own eyes is because they didn't have a righteous king who was teaching them. In other words, the king has a teaching role, not just a ruling role. It's not just, oh, he tells them, you know, all the people, yeah, you're good, you're bad, you know, I'm going to kill you, I'm not going to kill you, whatever. The king was to set an example for all the people of following the law, following what God had said. In fact, if you remember back in Deuteronomy 17, Moses predicted there would be kings, and Moses said, when you ask for a king, make sure he writes out in his own handwriting this law. Wow. Have your own copy of the Bible, king, that you've written out in your own handwriting, if you can read your handwriting. Can you guys read your handwriting? I have a hard time reading my handwriting, so I type things out, but anyway. Write it out so you can read it and you can study it. And in fact, study it daily. You can look at the end of Deuteronomy 17. There's your command for daily quiet time. Okay, in case you were wondering if it's in the Bible. Yes, it is for kings. Okay, I understand. You say, well, I'm not a king. And in Ruth, we see the monarchy is prepared. A lot of good that would be for God just to say, oh, yeah, you need a monarchy, but I'm not going to help you. No, God was there providing the ancestry of David, going all the way back to Abraham. David is the link between Abraham and Jesus, and that's through the book of Ruth. Now as we get into the book of Samuel, we see the monarchy is established. What God has shown that we need, what God has prepared, now God actually does in the book of Samuel. You see this depicted through two of the key cities in Samuel. Bethlehem is presented in a very bad light in Judges. Bethlehem is where this idolatrous priest comes from, who leads the whole tribe of Dan astray. Bethlehem is where the concubine comes from that ends up getting sliced up into 12 pieces and almost leads to the tribe of Benjamin almost becoming just eradicated. But when we get to Ruth, all the Bethlehemites are blessing one another in the name of the Lord. And Boaz is from Bethlehem. And Bethlehem becomes transformed from a land of famine to a land of prosperity. So Bethlehem is presented in a completely opposite light, more positive light, when we get to Ruth. And now as we get to Samuel, we realize, wow, Bethlehem is where David's from. Because Obed's born there. Obed has a son named Jesse. Jesse has a son named David. So we go three generations later and we see, wow, God was working for that city of Bethlehem. Just like the Lord does right now. He works through family lines. God works through places. And he's you know, as I was telling you earlier, the ATA, the Asia Theological Association, is realizing this, that we need to pass this baton to the next generation. That's why you're here. I want to pass this baton to you. All of you, if not most of you, all of you are younger than me. I want to pass the baton to you. Say, run with this to your own generation. Gibeah, on the other hand, is the place where the murder takes place in Judges 19 and 20. So sad, where Gibeah of the Benjamites is the place where almost all the Benjamites, except for 600 of them, die. Now when we get to the book of Samuel, we learn that Saul is from Gibeah. And we're supposed to say to ourselves, really? Saul is related to all these people who just acted so dishonorably that the rest of the tribe said, we're going to kill you all. Saul comes from that, from these not-so-righteous Gibeahites. And so these concepts kind of link these books together. God's working behind the scene toward monarchy, but people have to respond to that. Saul's community is really not doing that, and Saul ends up just basically living for himself in the book of Samuel. But David gets this heritage from his father and his grandfather of not living for himself in light of what we said about Ruth. And it's a wonderful picture. Just to see how these are divergent ways to go here. Yes?
The kings weren't really that much better than the judges in the end. What was happening before in the end, if you look at Second Kings, right, or even First Kings.
Yeah.
Was it any better?
Were the kings any better than the judges?
Time of the kings any better than the time of the judges?
I think it was. I think the time of the kings was better, especially when you look at the southern kingdom. They have 20 kings, and 8 of them were deemed to be righteous kings. So they're almost at 50%. 40% is still a failing grade, right? But in the northern kingdom, then we'll see as we get into Kings, of their 20 kings, 0 of them really honor the Lord. But the kings did do better. David certainly did far better than Saul did. But there was a lot of authority that was placed in one person when you get to Samuel, as opposed to the time of the judges, where the authority was dispersed among many different judges, having smaller areas in which they ruled. So there was a lot more potential to do good, but also to do harm for that single monarch to exercise his influence. We all know this today is the same. When a man or woman has a great amount of authority, they can use that authority for good or for ill. A lot of people can be blessed from it, but a lot of people can get hurt from it as well. But you do find that those who were in the line of David, several of them did end up honoring the Lord. But there was a whole wave of under them of idolatry, of people that didn't really want to follow them in their righteous ways. And that's definitely a big problem. So what we actually see happening are three transitions going on in the book of 1 Samuel. So that's why I have transition as the key idea here. In the first case, we have the transition from Eli, the old king, who really wants to follow the Lord, but his sons don't follow his ways. But little boy Samuel is under his influence, and Samuel doesn't actually become like Eli in the sense of being godless. He did become like Eli in the sense that his sons also didn't follow in his ways. But that's this first transition from Samuel to Eli. One of Eli's problems related to marriage, I go, one wife's enough, and my wife agrees with that. So Eli doesn't get involved in all this, but, you know, Hannah is the second wife. And a lot of people say, well, you know, the Bible sure says a lot about polygamy. A lot of people are polygamous. Yeah, and my response is, yeah, and which one of them was happy? Give me one example of a family that was not dysfunctional in the scripture where there's more than one wife. Every one of them, there are huge issues related to that. In other words, just keep going back all the way back to Genesis 2, and it'll tell you how many wives each man's supposed to have, you know? So anyway, Hannah and Peninnah, they had their issues. And the sad thing is that Hannah is barren. She seems to really be honoring the Lord, but she's barren. And the other wife, Peninnah, doesn't seem to be honoring the Lord, but she has all these kids. Why is that? I can't tell you why. Except that God has his purposes in these things. So she prays for a son. God knows her heart, and we get into chapter 2, God answers. And she cares for Samuel. Even though she does fulfill her vow by saying, yeah, I will give him over to the Lord. And you have in these first 12 chapters, the account go back and forth between Samuel, who's righteous, but Eli's sons did evil in the sight of the Lord. But Samuel wore a little ephod, but Eli's sons, you know, slept with the women at the tabernacle. But Samuel was doing these wonderful things, but Eli and his sons were messing up. But Samuel was honoring Jesus, you know, God, you know. And it goes back and forth, and showing that God was truly honoring the righteousness that Samuel was demonstrating. All right? Samuel grows up. And his word comes to all Israel. He seeks to follow the Lord. And Eli, allows the ark to actually get captured. He allows the ark to be looked at as like a war trophy or helping the people in war. So the Philistines end up defeating Israel and they capture the ark. And Eli ends up dying as a result of it, hearing all this. It's a rather interesting account, kind of a funny account when you get into when the Philistines, they capture the ark, but the ark and the statue of Dagon are there in the same room. And Dagon, boy, he loses his arms, loses his head. You'd think the Philistines would catch on, you know? And the ark gets transferred among the various cities of the Philistines. And they end up sending the ark back along with golden rats, which seems to indicate that God sent some kind of plague that was coming from these rats. And so they bring the ark back. What should be Israel's next move to protect the ark when it comes back? It's interesting. There's a sense of honor that's accorded to the ark by the Philistines. I mean, after all, their people are getting sick and dying. They go, whoa, there's a lot of power in Israel.